You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show do not reflect the opinions of KUCI or the Regents of the University of California. Hi, I'm Tina Spindler, and welcome to In the Garden with University of California Master Gardeners. I'm the host today for our program on fruit trees, deciduous fruit trees, and I'm really excited because we have, in my opinion, one of the premier experts on growing fruit trees in California. This is my pleasure to introduce Tom Spellman. He is the Southwest Sales Manager for Dave Wilson Nursery, also one of the premier growers of fruit trees in California and the United States. And Tom, thanks so much for coming today.
Tina, it's indeed my pleasure. And you just have to remember that my main attribute towards fruit growing is the fact that I'm old and I have about 40 years experience or more in doing it.
I don't know. If you're old, I'm old. I think we're near the same age, but you have way more experience growing fruit trees than I do. And I have to tell our audience that when I went through Master Gardener training 10 years ago, Tom was the lecturer for our chapter on deciduous fruit trees, and it was so freeing because, as you're going to hear, he has some information on backyard fruit culture, a backyard orchard culture that is really, really helpful to backyard fruit growers like me. So I'm really excited to get started. But first, let's talk a little bit about where you come from. The Dave Wilson Nursery, which I had the pleasure of you inviting me to go up there a few years ago, is one of the largest growers of deciduous fruit and nut trees in the U.S., and their growing grounds that I went to, which were awesome, are in the Sierra Nevada foothills up near Hickman, which is a beautiful area and was really fun to go visit. Can you tell us a little bit about the range of fruit trees that you guys produce up there?
Well, sure. The nursery was started back in 1938 by Dave Wilson and his wife Isabel, and they started the nursery to supply material to commercial agriculture, peach growers, plum growers, almond growers, you know, throughout the Central Valley. And the nursery kind of evolved. They've worked on several different pieces of property. The properties that they have now in the Central Valley total about 3,000 acres, and that's all in a rotation program. So in any given year, we're harvesting about 700 to 800 acres of tree material.
Wow.
So we grow a little over 10 million trees a year.
Oh, my gosh. That's unfathomable.
And yeah, we supply the commercial agricultural industry. We supply farmers market growers and organic growers. We supply the wholesale and retail nursery industry throughout the United States. So it's been a great ride for me. They're a wonderful group of people to work with, and they've, strangely enough, they've kind of given me free rein to manage myself and you know, travel around the country and lecture and talk to people about fruit and sell fruit trees. So it's been really fun. And one of the things that I've really had the pleasure of doing is working on projects like a couple that we have here at the field station that are specifically geared towards backyard orchard culture. And backyard orchard culture is a completely different technique than what a commercial farmer would use. And the reason that we started to promote backyard orchard culture in the first place was, oh, more than 20 years ago, we started looking at information that was provided to the backyard growers, and we found that most of that information was funded by commercial agriculture, and there were projects through the California UC system that kind of taught people how to be a farmer. And we just thought, you know, there's so many differences. You know, I mean, one of the main differences is, you know, a farmer is going to grow 20, 30, 50 acres of one variety and want to come in and harvest that variety all at one time. So they come in with big equipment and lots of people, and they do their work, and they get their fruit washed and graded and sent to cold storage and sent to market, and they get their check. That's how they make their living.
Right.
So they need big quantities at one time. Well, I don't know any backyard grower that needs the amount of fruit that a commercial tree would produce in a 2 or 3 week period.
No, absolutely. In fact, we would prefer to have our fruit over a much longer period of time.
Absolutely, and that's one of the main focuses or main concepts of backyard orchard culture, is growing a number of successive ripening varieties so that you'll have a little bit of fruit all the time instead of a lot of fruit at any one given time.
Absolutely. So that your neighbors don't cringe when you come walking down the street trying to pawn off, you know, some more peaches.
You've heard my lecture.
Yes. I have heard your lecture several times. And if you ever have the opportunity, if you hear of Tom speaking at a local nursery, I heartily advise any of our listeners to come listen. He has such wisdom about this for us homeowners who really have very little experience doing this, because by and large we'll have the opportunity to plant, you know, one or two varieties of any particular fruit, perhaps in our lifetime if we stay put in the same house. So learning how to do that from someone like you so that we can have successive harvests and good varieties and know how to take care of those things is just hugely important. So first let's define for folks what kind of fruit trees we're talking about today, because we're not talking about citrus, we're talking about deciduous fruit trees.
Well, really what we're concentrating on today is more technique than a class of fruit trees. You know, I think to be successful with backyard orchard culture, you need to work in as many types of fruits as you can, because let's face it, deciduous fruit trees are going to give you late spring and summer season and into fall. So you've got, you know, the early peaches and apricots in early May coming into varieties that will ripen through the summer into apples and pears and persimmons that will ripen into the fall and hold until winter. So deciduous fruit trees in general are not going to give you 12 months worth of successive ripening fruit. They're going to give you about 7 or 8. So once we incorporate some avocados, we incorporate some citrus, we incorporate some other subtropicals or berry vines or blueberries or things like that into this program, now we can round it out. Now we can do a program that's going to include successive ripening varieties so that we have a little bit of fruit on a year-round basis.
That's awesome. So before, when I've heard you talk, the lectures have been primarily focused on the deciduous fruit trees, but I love to hear what you're saying, because you've extended this backyard orchard culture to encompass a variety of fruit trees and, it seems like, shrubs as well.
Absolutely, and I think it's important that people take all of that into consideration. Different types of plant material, different types of growing methodology, you know, from container culture to espaliers to hedgerows to multi-planted or multi-grafted combinations, so that you can incorporate as many different types of fruit as possible into a fairly small residential landscape.
Wow, that's awesome. Who doesn't want to have fresh fruit from their own yard 12 months out of the year? That'll be great. So first, if we can maybe focus on some of the deciduous fruit trees, because I know I hear a lot of folks ask a lot of questions about what type should they plant, when should they plant them, try to educate them a little bit about winter chill so that they choose the right varieties. So for the folks who are new to fruit trees, can you explain a little bit about the selection process, what winter chill is?
Absolutely. So the first two considerations are, number one, geography. Where are you located? That's going to determine what you're going to be able to successfully grow in that area. And number two, soil type. Soil type is just as important as geography. If you have an acidic soil or an alkaline soil, if you have a heavy soil or a fast-draining soil, these are all considerations for how varieties are going to perform in that specific area. So those are the first two things I like people to take a look at. Where are they located, you know, and what is their soil type? And as long as you have reasonable drainage, and, you know, I think we're concentrating on mainly
Orange County, Southern California, Orange County growers
right now. So
yeah.
You'd mentioned chill hours. That's a very important consideration for Orange County. Orange County is a relatively low chill accumulation region in Southern California. So,
can you give our listeners who aren't familiar with the term what the definition of chill hours are?
Let's do that. So the scale is based on winter chill accumulation from November 1st until January 31st. And we're taking into consideration hours between freezing, 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and 45 degrees Fahrenheit. So we're looking for that 90-day period of an accumulation of all those hours between 45 and freezing. So that's your first number. That's the base number of chill hours that you've accumulated. And then, by some models, they calculate that any hours above 70 in that same 90-day period of time need to be subtracted from that accumulation total.
That part I didn't know.
So in Orange County, this year, I would assume that we're probably in the 200 to 300 hour range.
Oh, good.
We had pretty good accumulation. It was cool in November. It was cool in December. It was cool in January. And those are the main 3 months of concern. What happens after January 31st, as soon as the early varieties start to bloom, doesn't really take into consideration anymore. So we had fairly good chill, and we had very few hours in that period of time that were above 70. So
oh, good.
Very few hours that are going to reduce on our total.
And now, what does chill do to the plant that makes it produce?
Chill, especially early chill in Southern California, helps set the varieties into a proper dormancy. And that's one of the things that we've always had trouble with in Southern California. If we looked at 2014 and 2015 accumulations of chill, were probably negative chill in Orange County.
We probably certainly
had less than 50 accumulated hours of chill in 2014 and 2015. So it was a horrible two seasons for deciduous fruit trees.
Right. I know it was in my yard.
Yeah. So this year we're having a fairly decent year. And I want people to take this into consideration that chill is not something that is absolutely a set number.
Okay.
The most important consideration in Southern California is that we get an early dormancy and a full dormancy. So when we do accumulate chill hours in November and December, varieties go dormant on time, that's much more important than the total accumulation of hours during that 90-day period.
See, I knew I would learn stuff today. That's really good to know.
And this year they did. We had, if you looked around town at the liquid ambers and the ginkgos, they had really nice fall colors this year, and they held for quite a while, and deciduous fruit trees went into a good hard dormancy. So that's what we need. That's what we need to put them into a good night's sleep so that they, you know, wake up feeling refreshed and can bloom and do their projects and set their fruit.
Wow, that's awesome. So I'll keep my fingers crossed that this year will be better than it has been the last couple of years.
Oh, it absolutely will be.
Oh, good. So you were saying that you have some test plots at the UC Research Station. What is it that you're testing out there?
Well, there are three projects that I'm involved with here. The first one was put in about 8 years ago, and that was an interspecific trial. And interspecifics are hybrid fruits that are a combination of more than one species. So pluots, apriums, nectar plums, things like that. They're not genetic modifications. They're strictly hybrids.
So they're
all within the same genus, Prunus. So a peach, a plum, a nectarine, an apricot, an almond, a cherry, they're all actually in the same family of Prunus. So now we've taken different species out of that family, like apricot and plum, or cherry and plum, or peach and plum, and we've been able to hybridize those by transferring pollen from a paternal tree to a maternal tree.
Sure.
So, you know, father to mother, and then researching those seedlings that come off of that cross to determine if the characteristics that we're looking for have been inbred into the fruit.
Sure, and so that's just old-fashioned
cross-pollination. Yeah. It's the way they've come up with all the tomato and pepper varieties and all the melon varieties and all the different things that have been grown for centuries.
Right. You know,
hybridization is ancient. It's not a new technique, and it is in no way, shape, or form a genetic modification.
Right. So the varieties that you are testing here, how long does it take for those to go from the test phase to the consumer?
I'm not trialing anything here that isn't already released to the trade.
Got it. Okay.
I'm mainly trialing varieties here just to determine how they'll do under low chill Orange County conditions.
Interesting.
So the interspecific trial, it's mainly pluots and apriums. In its eighth year, I think probably this will be its final year.
Uh-huh.
I think probably sometime after harvest season this summer, that project will be taken out. It's given me all of the information I've been looking for on calculating the low chill varieties out of the program, and we've had several really good harvests out of the program and had some really good fruit out of the program. So all of the information that I can really gather has probably already been determined, and at that point, the project is probably obsolete.
So do Apriums and Pluots do well in Orange County?
Oh, absolutely.
They do.
We have some selections that I would not recommend,
and
probably a dozen different selections that I would highly recommend.
And those recommendations, I believe, would be on your Dave Wilson website. Is that
absolutely
true?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So for our listeners, if you want to know about fruit trees, the best place to go to learn about fruit trees and backyard orchard culture is the Dave Wilson website. And do you want to give that website address?
Yeah, it's www.davewilson.com. And then go to the backyard grower, home grower section, and you won't be blasted with information on being a commercial farmer, but you'll get backyard growing information.
Yeah, and the interesting thing that I found so helpful there is that it does focus on or has information for our low-chill areas so that you can see whether a particular variety is appropriate for where we live.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So thanks for filling everybody in about chill hours. I even learned more about chill hours than I knew before, so that was super, super helpful. The other thing I think I get a lot of questions as a master gardener when I'm out in the community is people want to know, well, why should I buy? I know for size, maybe I should think about getting a dwarf tree, but then I see when I go to the nursery that there are dwarf, there are semi-dwarf, and then there are trees that aren't labeled either of those. Can you explain to our listeners what they should know about each of those size type of fruit trees?
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, there are so many variables when it comes to rootstock designations. Now, if we look at the category that we call true dwarf or genetic dwarf, those are actually fruit trees, peach varieties, nectarine varieties that will probably never get any bigger than about 6 feet. And those are varieties that are actually dwarf within themselves.
Oh.
So it doesn't matter what rootstock they're grafted onto. They can be grafted onto a standard or a semi-dwarfing rootstock, and they'll still stay very small, no more than 5 or 6 feet. So that would be the first classification, what we would call true dwarf or genetic dwarf.
And would those be the type of trees you would recommend for people who are growing in containers, like half wine barrels? Or
They work very well for container culture. They also work very well for miniature type gardens in very small spaces. So, you know, you could put three nectarines and three peach varieties in a space that's probably no more than 100 square feet.
Wow,
if
awesome.
You're using those genetic
yeah.
dwarfs. So, and there's some mighty tasty varieties there and big, beautiful double flower character on most of them.
Oh, so pretty.
So the second category would be what we call semi-dwarf. And this is where rootstock comes into play. These are varieties that are grafted onto a rootstock that would be less aggressive than what we would consider a full-size standard. And for the most part, semi-dwarfs are going to be dwarfed by somewhere between 15 and 30% below the size of a standard. So if we looked at, say, apples, and we had a Fuji apple on a standard rootstock that was unpruned, it could easily reach 25 or 30 feet. Now, if we took a Fuji apple and put it on a semi-dwarfing rootstock like Mollings number 7 or Mollings 111, we could expect it to be somewhere between 15 and 25% smaller in stature. So most people that plant a semi-dwarf fruit tree eventually look at this tree that's now 15, 18, or 20 feet tall, and they feel that they've been misled.
It's not as dwarf as they were expecting.
It's not as dwarf as they expect it to be.
Yeah.
So I tell people all the time, don't ever consider a semi-dwarfing rootstock for size control, because the size control isn't going to be that much greater than what a standard rootstock would provide.
Interesting.
So I always tell people the most important consideration, remember we talked on geography and soil adaptability?
Right.
So you want to know, is that rootstock adaptable to my climate and my soil?
Interesting.
Now, there may be a semi-dwarf that's adaptable to your climate and soil where a standard would not. Or it may be the other way around. A standard would be and a semi-dwarf wouldn't. So it's much more important to have a tree that's going to survive in your geographic area and your soil type, and then you choose the size of the tree by pruning.
Yes, which I want to get to in a second, because I do love your backyard orchard pruning philosophy. That has released me from constraints that I used to put on myself. But before we get there, when you're talking about the soil consideration being the number one thing to think about when you're choosing the rootstock, how do you find out what rootstock is best for your soil?
Well, again, I'd refer you back to our website. There's a full category of the variety descriptions as well as rootstock descriptions on our website.
And do the rootstock descriptions let you know whether it's good for clay soil sandy soil, et cetera?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh,
those are indicated
awesome.
On the labels on the trees that we sell, and it's also indicated in the variety descriptions in our catalog and on the website.
And then because you're a wholesale grower, you don't sell to homeowners. Homeowners would be able to find those varieties at a local nursery.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
And another one of the services on our website is a retail source list.
Okay.
So, you know, you can look up Orange County and find all the nurseries in Orange County that would sell our material. You can find mail order sources. You know, you can actually click on an individual nursery and a list of their entire inventory will come up.
Oh, wow.
You can see everything that they're purchasing from us for resale.
That I did not know. I've never tried that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's very cool. Okay, back to size, because this was one of the topics that you covered when I was going through training 10 years ago that was so incredibly valuable to me, because I was always afraid to prune my fruit trees because I wasn't a pruning expert, and as a result, some of those fruit trees were getting beyond my reach for harvest and for, you know, caring and dormant spraying and all of that kind of stuff, until you said your fruit tree size is under your control. So explain to our listeners how it's under their control.
Well, it started out when years ago people would always give me this pointed question, how big should my fruit trees be?
Uh-huh.
And it got to a point where people were actually accusing me of telling them how big a tree they should grow. When in fact, I'm not doing that. What I'm encouraging people to do is consider what's manageable for them. So if a 6-foot tree or an 8-foot tree or a 15-foot tree is manageable to you, then you can choose that size. And you can choose to keep your trees pruned out at whatever you consider to be that manageable size. But the main thing is choose a size and stick with it. You know, if you choose 8 feet, then every time your tree grows larger than 8 feet, you know that all that growth above 8 feet is never going to be production wood because you're not going to leave it there long enough.
Right.
So when the tree grows to 9 or 10 or 12 feet and you only wanted 8, take the top out.
And when should folks take the top out?
Well, there's a couple of different schools of thought on pruning. And I have a philosophy that I like to manage fruit tree size in the summer. And it's easily done in the summer because that's when you get the majority of your growth. So I can look at trees in August or early September and say, okay, this tree that I want at an 8-foot size is now 10 feet, so I can easily take 2 feet off the top. I'm limiting the amount of growth. At that point, I won't get too much regrowth. And then I can consider winter pruning for detail. So summer pruning should pretty much strictly be size control.
So in fact, height.
I tell people, don't even consider anything else. Don't look for issues. Just choose a size and prune to that size. Now, when wintertime comes around, especially with deciduous fruit trees, they're going to go dormant, which is nice because now you can see the skeletal structure of that tree, and you can make all those important decisions that you didn't make in the summer. I can open up the center. I can take out wood where it's crisscrossing. I can look for dead wood, diseased wood, broken branches, anything that I consider to be, you know, out of bounds for that tree. Is it now too wide? Does it stick out over a sidewalk? Whatever. I can do all of those detailed chores in the winter when I can see everything about the tree. I can see the size and the structure.
Because there are no leaves on it.
There are no leaves on it.
You can see
right
it.
There.
Right,
so
right.
All of those decisions are easily made in the summer, in the winter, where during the summer months, you can't see most of that, and you should really just be considering your maximum height.
Right. Well, that's great advice. I mean, I've been following that for the last 10 years, and I'm so much happier that my peach and apricot trees are of a manageable size. And what I do is I just take my loppers, and as far as my reach is with the loppers at the end of my arms, that's how tall my trees get to be so that I don't ever have to get up on a ladder.
That's a perfect guideline.
Yeah.
That's the perfect philosophy to follow. That's the maximum size that's manageable for you, and it's an easy size to determine just by standing on the ground and working your way around the tree.
Yeah, and as you said, to prune them in the summer, it takes no brain power. You just go around and cut them so that you have it all that manageable height that you want, and then it's so much easier in the wintertime to go in and make those decisions about how you want to open the tree up, as you said, or I know in my case I have the trees planted not too close together, but close enough that I do want to control the width of the tree as
Absolutely.
Well. So I can keep my three fruit trees there under control. You have some other interesting backyard orchard philosophies that start with planting, and I'm kind of sad that I didn't have the experience of the lecture before I actually planted my fruit trees, because I planted three individual fruit trees, you know, appropriately spaced side by side. But tell us a little bit about your philosophy of multiple trees in a single planting hole, because I think that's a genius way to get more fruit trees and extend your harvest.
Absolutely. It gives you the ability to grow three or four times the amount of trees in a small amount of space. And really what it means is you're either multiple grafting by adding varieties to your tree, you're buying a tree with three or four varieties already on it, or you're multiple planting, which would mean I want successive ripening peach varieties through the summer. So I would choose a variety that ripens in May, a variety that ripens in June, a variety that ripens in July, and one that ripens in August. And I would plant them in the footprint of what would be one commercial tree. So 100 to 150 square feet. Now four trees planted in that space. Size managed to 8 feet, and each tree gets 25% of that combination. So I'm never allowing the trees to get too big or too top-heavy or too side-heavy where they would topple over. I'm easily able to manage thinning and pruning and harvesting from standing on the ground, and I now have 3.5 months' worth of peaches out of the space where a commercial grower would have one harvest over a two-week period.
Which is so ideal for the backyard grower, because we can't, I know when my peach tree is in season, there's no way that we can eat all of those peaches. And I end up freezing a lot of them and making jam, you know, throughout the year. But I would so much have preferred to have four different peach trees and have a much longer harvest. It would have been, you know, wonderful to have in my own backyard.
Absolutely.
Can you describe, it's radio, so it's a little difficult, and your website actually has some great diagrams, but could you just briefly describe, okay, so I purchased these four trees, how big of a hole am I digging, and how am I placing those trees in that hole?
Well, again, that's really going to be determined by the needs of the landscape in general. You know, we've done 4-in-1 plantings, we've done 3-in-1 plantings, 2-in-1 plantings, we've done hedgerow style, we've done, you know, a spalliard material on trellises. So it's really all up to the individual grower what they're going to do. But probably the two most common methods that are being used are either a 4-in-1 done in a square pattern, or a 3-in-1 done in a triangular pattern. And in that case, you would choose the space that you want in between trees. Some people go very close. I've planted them as close as 12 or 18 inches apart, you know, where you're basically putting all four trees or all three trees in one hole.
Yeah.
And kind of angling them out from each other.
Uh-huh.
I've done 24 inches apart, 36 inches, 48 inches, you know, all different patterns. We've experimented with this now for over 20 years, and we've done every possible configuration that you can do. And we've found that, you know, as long as you're willing to manage it, they all work.
That's such great news. So there's no hard and fast rule. You can experiment or choose to have them 18 inches apart, up to 4 feet apart.
Yeah.
But basically, yeah, what determines how well they do is your management of that in the
future. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it does require a little more intense management than what a commercial grower would do. Like I said, most commercial growers are going to prune one time a year. They're either going to prune in the summer or they're going to prune in the winter, where I'm recommending that a backyard grower prune twice a year.
Right.
I think you need to do size control in the summer and detail work in the winter. So that way you can easily manage that combination. If you want an open center, you can keep the trees, you know, growing outward from the center, and you can manage your size and just give each one of the trees one-third of the space or 25% of the space, you know, whatever the combination designates, and just go from there.
And you do that through the pruning. So
yes,
if one is a little more vigorous than another one, you are pruning that one to stay relatively the same size as the
exactly.
other trees.
Exactly. I think, managing size to a balance is one of the most important considerations, and it's why most people fail with multi-grafted trees. Multi-grafted trees will almost always favor one variety. So if I had, say, a peach and an apricot and a plum all on one tree, I would probably figure the peach is going to be the most vigor, or the plum is going to be the most vigorous upright grower, and will probably eventually outgrow the apricot and the peach if I don't control it. Yeah, so size balance is very important to success for backyard orchard culture.
Well, that's great. I'm going to pause just a second because it's time for me to let everyone know that you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And the opinions that we are expressing on this show do not reflect the opinions of KUCI or the Regents of the University of California. So you mentioned espalier, and that is another technique that we should probably let our listeners know about, because it's another technique that allows you to grow fruit trees in limited space.
Very, very much so. And I think, to me, I think it's probably one of the most exciting potentials for backyard fruit growing, because a lot of people have limited space. And, you know, if you have a south-facing or a west-facing planter bed along a wall, or, you know, along a patio or something, and you wanted to grow an apple tree or a peach tree or an apricot tree in an area that's only 18 or 24 inches wide, you can easily do that by espaliering that plant. And the nice thing about espalier is you're giving every branch on that tree equal exposure. You don't have a big 8-foot wide plum tree or apricot tree that's going to shade out everything in the center. You're growing on a flat surface. So every branch has equal exposure. So a fruit management thinning is very, very easy, and the harvest is wonderful, because you get everything of equal balance, equal size, equal exposure. Peak ripeness is all about the same time. So you can really get a good crop of material where all the fruit is uniform and of exceptional quality.
And I personally just love it. I have two espaliered fruit trees at my home, but for our listeners, if you really want to go see what you can do by espaliering fruit trees, go out to the Great Park in Irvine. There's a demonstration garden there called the Farm and Food Lab, and thanks to Dave Wilson Nurseries, about, 5 years ago maybe, they were kind enough to donate an initial donation of 30 various deciduous fruit trees, and so you'll be actually be able to see peaches, apricots, apriums, pluots. We have so many different varieties, and they're all the low chill varieties. They have little signs out there that identify the variety, and some little bit of information that was actually taken from the Dave Wilson website about their flavor and when they ripen. And so if you aren't real sure what espalier means, it's a great place to go locally so that you can see it. And then in addition, a year or two later, we planted, oh gosh, I don't even know how many feet, 100 plus feet of two varieties of apples that are espaliered along a fence, which is just a great example. If you have a backyard fence, which we pretty much all do, if it's south-facing and getting good sun, absolutely plant some espaliered fruit trees along it. Why not? It will disguise the look of that, you know, plain, not-too-attractive fence, and will give you edibles in the long run also. So great way to incorporate some fruit trees in your house. Also, I know one wall I wish I had put an espaliered fruit tree on. I have a two-story wall one side of my house, and I went to a garden tour once, and someone had on their two-story wall espaliered a pear that went up two stories. And when this thing was in bloom, it was spectacular up against the wall of that house. I don't know how they harvested it, but it sure looked pretty.
Well, you know, so you harvest it with a ladder, but the nice thing is it's all easy to manage and easy to get to.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're moving a ladder all the way around the tree. You've got one flat surface on a wall. So
yeah.
That's a situation where a 15-foot tree can be completely manageable.
Right.
So, you know, again, I'm not telling anybody that they have to control tree size to 8 feet. It's what's ever manageable for you.
Yeah.
And I, by the way, I love the planting at the Great Park. I try and sneak in there 3 or 4 or 5 times a year and look at what you guys are doing, and I'm always impressed at you know, the beautiful gardens there, the the wonderful way that you guys have incorporated edibles into an ornamental style. And those espaliers are just beautiful. You guys have done a great job on
that. Oh, thanks. Well, it also allowed us in not just the espaliered area, but in one of the larger demonstration beds. We also did take advantage of that space to do a couple of the same hole, multiple trees in the same hole planting. So that's also a place, if you're not real sure what we're talking about, that you can go out and actually see that. But the diagrams on your website are also awesome to give people a good idea how to go about doing that. Before we get off the topic of espaliered fruit trees, I actually have an espaliered apple that has three different varieties of apples on it. Can you explain to our listeners how that's possible?
Well, again, that's just the technique of multiple grafting. So what we do is we grow a rootstock up to about 4 feet high, and then we bud opposite of each other, you know, two buds of a variety. So say Dorset Golden on top and Fuji in the middle and Anna down at the bottom with two buds of each. So
how did you know? That's exactly what I have.
I know exactly what you have.
Because I bought it.
I know the tree well. So it's just a way to give people a head start so that they don't have to try and do that form themselves, and give them the opportunity to have three varieties on one tree. So, you know, you can buy pre-espalier trees like that, or you can just start by making a low cut at about knee high and grow those out into a fan shape or a three or four tiered shape, however it works for you, and grow your own.
Yeah, and I was very excited, and I love the one that I have that was already grafted with the three varieties, because, again, it extends my apple harvest. So mm-hmm. I don't have apple harvest all at one time. I have it spread out over several months, which is awesome. And that was the first espalier tree I bought because I was too intimidated to try espaliering a tree myself. But I have to tell you, after working out at the Great Park, you're exactly right. All you need is a pair of hand pruners and a little bit of imagination, and you just basically clip out anything that's growing in a direction that you don't want it to grow in, so that you end up with just the branches that are growing out side to side. And you can do it in a very formal cordon shape where you have, you know, the cordons at, you know, 2 feet and then another, you know, foot higher than that. But out at the Great Park, especially with the stone fruits, which are not as easy to control in a very organized manner like the apples, we just basically let them fan their way up the fence in whatever way they want, and we just keep cutting off the branches that are pointing out in the wrong direction, and it works perfectly well, and they're really fun, and we get lots of fruit off of them.
Exactly. You know, people are sometimes intimidated by things like that, but once you start to spend a little time with it, and once you start to work with it a little bit, you realize how simple those procedures are and how fun they can be and how space-saving and really, you know, making good use of the space that you do have available.
Yeah, we really have. One thing that we did try out there recently that isn't as far along as the others, and you mentioned it, is we're growing trying to grow avocados in a hedgerow. Can you explain that concept to our listeners?
Well, that really, it's interesting because that's something that we started looking at through backyard orchard culture, and it's a technique that the commercial growers have actually
taken a hold of.
You know,
oh, wow.
Something interesting happened in the avocado industry about 25 years ago, in that the liability insurance company started to go out on the avocado ranches and look at people climbing 40 and 50 feet up in the air to pick avocado fruit, and they basically told the ranchers, "Hey, we're not going to insure you anymore. This is crazy. You can't have people doing this." So some really intelligent people through the California Avocado Society and some of the UC and Cal Poly professors kind of got together and brainstormed a little bit and thought, well, if we bring that tree size back down — these trees were on big, wide spacings, 25 feet apart.
Wow.
And if we bring that tree size down, then we can plant more trees in the middle.
Huh.
So where we had 10 trees in a row, we can double plant or triple plant in between, and now we have 25 or 30 or even 40 trees in that row, and we're controlling tree size so that the trees don't get over about 15 feet tall, so that most of the work can be done from small ladders or from ground level. And what they found after about 5 or 6 years was that their yield went up by about 50% per acre.
Oh, my gosh.
So development costs were a little bit higher, but when you start considering what an avocado's worth...
Yeah, they're not cheap.
Yeah, and if you can increase your yield by 50% or even more per acre, well, now all of a sudden this makes perfect sense.
Sure.
So where avocado groves used to be planted at 25 feet apart, some of the new groves are planted at even 7 or 8 feet apart in a spalier or you know, let's say hedge type rows.
Right. So for the home, if I wanted to do that, because I have a long driveway that is got podocarpus along the driveway, because that was planted before I knew about this backyard orchard culture. What I would love to do instead is I would love to have a hedgerow of avocados. So how wide could I let those avocados get? Is there a minimum width that those avocados need to produce, would you say?
Well, I think the main consideration is how wide do you want your hedge to get. You
right.
Know? So you're going to, again, you're filling valuable space, so you need to consider your space needs. I would think on avocados, you probably don't want anything much narrower than about 6 feet.
Mm-hmm. So at 6 feet, you could get production.
Absolutely. In that 6 to 8 foot wide range, you could easily get good production on avocados. And, you know, avocados are just wonderful to grow. You know, I mean, let's face it, they're now considered a superfood.
Right.
You know, I like to eat an avocado or a half an avocado every day.
Had one for breakfast this morning.
Absolutely,
yeah.
As well as I. And, you know, if you can grow your own and save a dollar a piece, or even if you can supplement, maybe you have varieties that are ripe through the summer, varieties that are ripe through the fall, so you only have to buy them for 6 months or 4 months out of the year. So then you start looking at what is that tree as an investment? You know, when you start looking at the payback, what did I spend on that tree? What do I spend on management of that tree? And how much do I get back every year? And every single year, the yield goes up. So, you know, I wish my investment portfolio did near as well as my avocado trees.
No kidding. Yeah. I just think it's a great thing for homeowners who are either buying a new home and planning their landscape, or those of us who have existing homes where the landscape could stand to be refreshed, to consider planting these edible trees. I mean, we all know that water is going to continue to be scarce and it's going to continue to get more expensive. So if we're going to be watering something, why not water something that's going to give us a return in the form of food? And so I'm really trying to encourage folks as I'm out in the community to consider planting edible trees instead of decorative trees so that they're getting more bang for their buck for the water.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are edible trees that fall into all categories as far as tree shape, tree size, flower colors, fall colors, you know, for different types of function in the landscape. So, you know, where I wanted to plant a magnolia tree, or where I wanted to plant a evergreen pear tree or something like that, now I can choose a fruit tree that's going to give me the same form, the same function, the same growth pattern and style, and now I can harvest fruit off of it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you don't have to sacrifice design to get a fruit tree.
You can
choose one that fits with the design characteristics that you want.
Yeah, absolutely.
So speaking about irrigation, since El Nino hasn't really shown up much here, when I visited your demonstration gardens up at the nursery, and you're in the Central Valley, so it gets pretty darn hot up there. I assume you guys are using drip irrigation to irrigate. Is that correct?
That's correct. We're using a spinner system that throws about a 6 foot wide pattern, but it's I think it's 2 gallons per hour per emitter.
Wow.
And it's on a little bit of a gradual slope, but the philosophy is that we have no runoff. So it's mulched heavily, and when we do irrigate, we irrigate low and slow and make sure that it soaks in well. And we normally, even up in the San Joaquin Valley there, where we definitely see, you know, 30 to 45 days above 100 degrees
right.
every summer,
right?
We're typically only irrigating that project about every 2 to 2.5 weeks.
Really? Even in the heat of summer?
Yes.
Wow. Let that be a lesson to us who live in Orange County, where we don't get those 100-degree days like that. But I think most people think they have to irrigate their fruit trees a lot more often than that.
As long as you're mulching thick and properly, which, you know, I highly, highly recommend. In fact, anybody that's ever listened to my lectures knows one of the first things I talk about in mulching is if you're not mulching, your landscape should be colored gravel and a pink flamingo. You don't deserve to grow trees if you're not mulching. You shouldn't be growing trees.
Right.
So, you know, mulching is a procedure that, in my opinion, is a must if you're going to grow anything other than grass, really.
And explain to, because we'll probably have some listeners who are new to gardening, explain to them what the process of mulching is and what material you use to mulch.
Well, I favor a recycled green waste type material, which is readily available from a lot of the city programs or the local green waste recyclers in the area. You can buy it in a bag at the retail nursery, but it's pricey.
Yeah.
You know, it might cost you $6 or $7 for a 2 cubic foot bag, where if you go to the green waste recycler, you can get a cubic yard or more for $10 or $15.
Right.
So, you know, you're getting several hundred dollars worth of material for $10 or $15.
So borrow somebody's pickup
truck. Borrow somebody's pickup truck.
Yeah.
Or if you need a lot, they'll deliver it for you.
That's true.
You know, one of the things to consider is all of our green waste, almost all of our green waste in Southern California is now being recycled. And they're using it all over. They're using it at park projects. They're using it on freeway projects. They're using it in all kinds of new landscape projects. People have kind of been afraid of it because they think that there are pathogens or bacteria or diseases or termites or things like that that the mulch might, you know, put into their landscape. Mm-hmm. And I found that that was totally untrue. You know, green waste recycled mulch is, in my opinion, the way to go. It's the nice thing about it is a combination of a number of different types of organic wood products. So as opposed to all cedar mulch or all redwood compost or something like that, you get the biodiversity of all these different products.
Absolutely, and that's great for a garden.
It's chopped down into smaller form. It works well, it lands well, it breathes well. So I've been a big advocate of recycled green waste for well over 30 years. And all of the things that people have been afraid of over the years, I've never seen any of those things happen.
Well, you were way ahead of your time. If you've been doing, recommending mulch for that long.
Well, we knew it was coming. We knew that recycling was happening and that they weren't just going to continue to throw this stuff in the landfill. So, you know, they've been looking for all these projects and ways to use it, and now they're actually at a point where they're making more of it than ever, but there are so many outlets and so many people that are recognizing its value and using it, they're keeping up with pace. So
awesome.
It's nice to see that.
Yeah. The other thing that, I mean, there are a lot of benefits of mulch. One that we've already mentioned is conserving water and allowing you not to have to irrigate as often because the evaporation doesn't happen as quickly and the soil doesn't heat up as quickly. But my personal favorite is that it keeps the weeds down. I hate to weed. And, boy, if you mulch, you have very few weeds, and the few that germinate, you know, are in that loose mulch, and they're super easy to pull out.
Well, yeah. You know, I in my lecture, I talk about the four attributes of mulch, and some of them we already covered. Number one, a good 2 to 4 inch layer of mulch will actually keep your soil 15 to 20 degrees cooler than unmulched soil during the hot summer months. So it takes that physical stress off of the roots at ground level during the time when the trees need to make use of that the most.
Sure, it's like us standing under an awning and being shaded rather than standing out in
the full
sun.
Exactly. Yeah. Number two, a 2 to 4 inch layer of mulch will actually make better use of your irrigation water by 50%.
Wow.
And I was preaching this 15 years ago when we were getting 25 inches of rain. I think that's
15%,
important.
15%, that's
I think
huge.
That's important. That's a dollars and cents savings that can be easily calculated, and it'll probably pay for your mulch.
Absolutely.
Number three, increase in mycorrhizal activity, earthworms, beneficial insects and fungi. It brings all of those back to the soil, and it allows the trees and the plants and your roses and your tomatoes and whatever to grow in a much more natural style. So they become naturally resistant to insects or pests or diseases, where if you had just bare soil, you wouldn't have any of those natural resistances.
Right.
So really important. If for no other reason, it's important for that. And
yeah.
If that was the only reason, I would still preach it as much as I do.
Yeah.
And then the one that you mentioned keeps weed seeds from germinating. No weed is going to germinate through a 2 to 4 inch layer of mulch. So it's taken my weeding time down by 90%.
And by and large, that's the least favorite task of all gardeners.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, so mulch, that's the moral of this story, is mulch, mulch, mulch. Your trees will be happier. You'll be happier because you're not paying higher water bills and weeding. So definitely mulch and borrow somebody's pickup. I love having a load of mulch delivered in my driveway, and then of course I have to bribe my husband to wheelbarrow it to where I want it to go. But you know, it burns a few calories. It's better than going to the gym and, you know, being on the Stairmaster or the treadmill. You're burning sweat in a real honest way. And hopefully you're going to get some, you know, peach pie or something in the long run as a reward. Yeah.
You know, I got an interesting little story that I want to throw in. A couple of months ago, I'm out working in my yard and out in the front, you know, right on the street. And my neighbor from down the street pulls up in his car and he rolls down the window and he goes, "Tom, what are you doing?" And I said, "I'm just working on my landscape." He goes, "Tom, why don't you hire a gardener? You know, you make enough money. You can afford a gardener." I said, "You know, Barry, I like to do this. You know, it's fun for me. I like to work in my landscape." I said, "What are you doing this afternoon?" He said, "Well, I'm going to the gym."
Exactly.
And I said, "You know what, Barry? I don't have to pay gym membership, and I don't have to pay a gardener, and here I am getting exercise and enjoying my landscape all at the same time."
Right. So, well, it's funny, in my neighborhood, I do the same thing, and of course, I always look, you know, like the homeless woman walking through the neighborhood because I have my old ratty gardening hat and my ratty gardening clothes on. And I've had gardeners come up, pull up their trucks and hand me a card and say, "Could you give this to the lady of the house?" Because they think I'm, you know,
I've had neighbors that wanted me to bid on their
landscape. On their landscape, yeah. But it's great exercise. It puts you in touch with your plants. You understand them better. And in the case of the edibles, you're going to get the reward in the long run from that labor. And like you said, save some gym fees by getting out there and doing it yourself.
There you go.
Yeah. A couple last questions about fruit tree care. We talked about pruning. Any advice about feeding your plants or pest control on the plants?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about each. Feeding is important, and a lot of people kind of neglect that. You know, they'll throw the nitrogen out on the lawn and make it look like a golf course, but they don't really feed their landscape. You know, their roses or their fruit trees or things like that. And they always have these expectations that, you know, oh, it's fine. You know, the mulch is going to provide it, or it's okay. The tree seems to do fine on
its own. Or that tree's been there for 10 years, you know.
But, you know, by starting a good feeding program, you will absolutely increase tree stability, root structure and stability. The right type of plant food will promote fruiting and flowering wood as opposed to vegetative growth. So what I always tell people on feeding of fruit trees is when you plant a young tree and you want to gain size, you want a manageable size structure, so you're going to get a good crop of fruit, that's when you can use the fruit tree foods that are a little higher in nitrogen.
Okay.
That's going to give you growth and a structure that's going to be fruiting for decades. Once you've reached that manageable size that you've chosen, at that point you want to slack back on the nitrogen as much as you can. Because at that point, nitrogen really becomes your enemy. It's going to give you more growth and less development of flowering wood for fruit.
And more to prune.
Exactly. More work to do, less fruit to harvest. So once you get the tree to the size you want to go to a fertilizer that's as low in nitrogen as possible, higher in the phosphorus and potash, and some trace elements. Zinc, iron, and manganese are all important trace elements. And they're going to be in very, very minor amounts. Almost nothing compared to what the P and the K, you know, will be in that bag of fertilizer. And I like the humic acid-based fertilizers. They're going to help to keep the soil, you know, neutral or slightly acidic. It's an easy organic carrier for the fertilizer. It's not detrimental to the mycorrhizal activity in the soil. So
that's good to know.
I'm always looking for
humic
low
acid.
Nitrogen, high phosphorus and potash, some trace elements, humic acid-based.
Oh, that's great
and
to know.
And then feeding time is important, too. You definitely want to feed through the growing season. So starting out late January, early February, and feeding through late June or early July. So either twice through the growing season or three times through the growing season, spaced out during that period. And you don't want to feed after that. You don't want to feed through the rest of the summer or fall, because that is kind of like the equivalent of going to Starbucks at 11 p.m. And getting your, you know, venti frappuccino with an extra shot of espresso.
Don't really need it at 11 p.m.
That's right. You drink that down and think, I'm going to go home and go to sleep, and what's going to happen? You're going to be up wide-eyed all night long.
And we do want these fruit trees, at least the deciduous ones, to go dormant.
That's exactly the point.
Yeah.
By feeding late in the season, it does not promote a good, strong, healthy dormancy. So, you know, forget that Starbucks at 11 p.m. Forget that feeding late summer and fall. So let the trees use up everything they have in the ground, and then that will help them to go into a good winter dormancy, which is exactly what they need.
I never thought of that. I usually don't feed late in the year anyway just because I'm too lazy, but that makes all the sense in the world why not to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
So really it's kind of 6 months on, 6 months off.
Yeah. Any words to the wise about pest control?
Well, I'm always real vague about pest control, number one, because we're in Southern California and we really have so few issues that we really need to deal with. You know, we'll have a little bit of aphid or a little bit of peach leaf curl or maybe some spider mite or, you know, citrus leaf miner or something like that. But they're relatively simple issues compared to what most of the rest of this country has to deal with.
Lucky us.
Absolutely. We're the luckiest gardeners there are. So the first thing I always say for pest control is make sure your issue is identified. Make sure you know what your problem is.
You sound like a master gardener.
Yeah, is it an insect? Is it a disease? Is it a bacteria, a fungus? If you don't know what it is, take some samples, fresh samples, put them in a Ziploc baggie. You can take them to the UC Master Gardener group, or you can take them to a retail nursery or garden center that you trust. Get the issue identified.
Yeah.
Only when you know what it is can an actual recommendation be made for control. And then my next question is always this: what's my organic alternative?
Right.
You know, I'm a big advocate of organics. I can't ever claim to be 100% organic, but I'm perfectly comfortable being 95% organic.
Sure, especially with things you're going to eat.
Right, and if it's something like citrus leaf miner, we have products out there that are OMRI-registered controls. There are new fungicides that are OMRI-registered controls. You know, we have more organic alternatives out there now than we've ever had in the past.
And so, just for our listeners who don't know what OMRI is, it's a designation that you'll see on all sorts of garden products. And when you see OMRI, OMRI, that just means that product has been certified for organic use.
Correct. So it can be used by certified organic growers that are growing organic, you know, produce for market.
Yeah.
And then my favorite tip for insect control through the summer season is keep your trees clean. Go out three or four times through the summer with your hose and a high pressure nozzle. Get the dust off, get the smog and the smut off the trees, get the old leaves and the cobwebs out of there. Just keep them clean. Keep the leaves clean, the branches clean.
Great advice.
If you have things like brown scale or woolly apple aphid or mealybug or things like that, just by going out there with the hose and the high pressure nozzle, you're going to physically remove about 90% of those issues.
And it's a fun thing to do on a hot day.
It's a fun thing to do on a hot day, absolutely.
Well, Tom, we have run out of time. I knew this hour was going to go by super fast, and it has. So I really want to thank you for taking the time to be on the show today. And to our listeners, please, when you have questions about fruit trees, go to the Dave Wilson website, www.davewilson.com. And also, you can go to the Master Gardener website, which is uccemg.com. You'll have a link to a podcast of this show if you want to tell other folks about it. And also there's a link to our hotline so that if you have any issues and you want a master gardener to take a look at a photo or address any concerns you have, you can do that as well. So again, thanks so much for coming today, Tom.
Thank you, Tina. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.